And with that, I'd like to hand it off to Carol Coltis, our Director of Special Projects. Take it away, Carol.
Thanks, Kate. Welcome, everyone. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, good. Thank you. For those of you who have been to our other breakfast forums where we talk about workforce issues, some of this might sound a little like a broken record, but I think it bears repeating. We are in an exceptional time right now if you are trying to recruit or retain good workers. We have more people dying than being born in this state. We have more people retiring from than entering the workforce. And we passed the four-year mark last month with unemployment rates below 4%. So it's a really extraordinary time for workforce challenges. In my conversations with our panelists in preparation for this event, they passed along some new data I was unaware of, and I thought I would share that with you this morning, too. And that is that for people who were in your workplace between the ages of 22 and 30, if they're an executive level, like a VP level, their average tenure with a company is 15 to 18 months. If it's a sales manager or someone at like an HR level position, that extends to 14 to 22 months. And Genevieve was telling me that 36% of new hires don't last 90 days. So if you're in a workplace and you have people working from different generations, you need to be attuned to how that affects your workplace and what you can do to make sure it's inviting, it's welcoming, it sustains your workforce so they're happy and they stick with you, because you don't want to be hiring right now. It's really difficult. And so just as a really quick overview, I know this also may be maybe trotting old ground, but just so we're all in sync in terms of what we talk about with multi-generations, I'll give you a really quick overview of the four generations we're going to talk about with a huge asterisk. This is a broad, sweeping generalization of these of folks who fall within these age groups, and you shouldn't take any of it as gospel. Certainly, people have different work characteristics. It's not all predicated on when they were born. But just to make sure we all understand what we're talking about here. So baby boomers were born between 1946 and 1964, generally speaking. They're optimistic, they're competitive, they can be workaholics, and they're team-oriented. They've been shaped by the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, and Watergate, and they're motivated by company loyalty, teamwork, and duty. Next up, we have Generation X, and those are folks born between 1965 and 1980. They're known for being flexible, informal, skeptical, and independent. They were shaped by the AIDS epidemic, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the dot-com boom, and motivated by diversity, work-life balance, we hear that a lot. There are personal professional interests rather than the company's interests. Now we have millennials in the workforce. They're born between 1981 and 2000. They're competitive, civic-minded, open-minded on diversity, and achievement-oriented. They were shaped by Columbine, by 9/11, and by the internet. Motivated by responsibility, the quality of their manager, and unique work experiences. And just now, we're starting to get the first of the Generation Z folks. They're born between 2001 and 2020. They are global, they're entrepreneurial, they're progressive, and they're less focused. Shaped by life after 9/11, the Great Recession, and access to technology from a young age. They're motivated by diversity, personalization, individuality, and creativity. So that's just a quick orientation, thanks to Purdue University. That's where I got that information from. And to unpack these issues, I've assembled what I think is a pretty phenomenal panel here. Let me do a brief introduction, and then we'll get the ball rolling. So to my immediate left is Dennis Boyle. He's president of Seacoast DX. He has spent 25 years in leadership training, with businesses as large as Siemens and Kodak, but also with a lot of small and medium-sized businesses. He's an adjunct professor at the University of New Hampshire. And here's my favorite thing about Dennis. He holds a certificate in business ethics and etiquette from the Emily Post Business Institute. So he's going to get...
I need it at the most. That's the reason why.
He's going to get all the etiquette questions. He's also a member in good standing of the Institute for Family-Owned Businesses here in Maine, and has consulted with more than 50 companies. So he has performed hundreds of seminars. He's got a really good base in this. Next to Dennis is Genevieve Fullalove. She's the Vice President of Permanent Placement Services at Robert Half. She's been there for more than 12 years. She started in the finance division of the company, but then has segued over to Vice President of the Permanent Placement Team. She has had a significant career in professional staffing, sat on the board of the Institute of Management Accountants, and has been sought after as a speaker for the International Association of Administrative Professionals. And she has a four-year-old, so she is our representative of the younger generation here on the panel. And then next to Genevieve is Debbie Olkin. She's Business Development Director, HR Consultant for KMA Human Resources Consulting. For nearly 20 years, she worked as an HR Director for two complex organizations, the Maine Judicial Branch and the Maine State Legislature. I can't imagine working for the Maine State Legislature in an HR capacity. So... she also has consulted with a variety of small and medium-sized businesses, and she's also she belongs to the Society of Professional Human Resource Managers, and she has served on the board of that association for Southern Maine. So, welcome to all of our panelists. Thank you for being here. Thank you all for chopping your cars out of your driveways this morning to get here. At least that was my experience. And let's get rolling. So the first question I wanted to ask is this. Oh, we'll have a question and answer around 8:45. And some of you had submitted questions when you registered for this event. If we don't get to those during our discussion this morning, the panelists have agreed to look at those questions after the fact. They'll try to answer them, and then we'll just distribute all of those answers via email, since you all provided your emails when you registered this morning. So hopefully we get all the bases covered. But first, we're going to start with this. We're going to ask about red flags. How do you identify communication problems between multi-generational employees? What is it that you should be watching for? And I'll throw that first question to Dennis to get the conversation started.
I better be good, right, for the first question?
That's right. Yes, the pressure's on.
You know, there's a couple things. In my generation, what I would have probably done if there were to look at red flags is I'd go to my manager, I'd be afraid. I would not roll it up the flagpole because I'd get in line, right? Now, today, what I find with companies with younger folks, you don't have to do any of that. They'll come right to the president of the company and say, we've got a problem, right? I've seen it all the time. So they communicate differently, and they tell you what's going on differently. I believe that behind that, there's a bigger issue. It's not the red flags that you see. It's how do you correct the red flags? So, and I'll talk about it later more, but the red flags are one thing. You're always going to have problems. But what you have to have is a performance management system or a conversation or a manager-to-employee relationship so that you can work through those problems. I will tell you this. The companies I work with, the number of times that they have these red flags and little problems that you and I... Well, at least me, when I was younger, I'd let it roll off my back. It becomes the end of the world. This is the most important thing, and that's a big difference. So typically what I look at after that pontification is a little more along the lines of, is it affecting productivity and people working together in a workplace environment?
So you identify that as a communication problem and whether it affects productivity?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. I mean, this is what we're talking about. At the end of the day, if you have people that are working effectively, your company grows, people want to work there, and you can attract people. So that's what you have to look for and try to solve and be aware of, I think.
And Genevieve, what do you see as red flags?
Can everyone hear me okay? Do I need to go closer? you know, I think communication is a big thing for sure. And Dennis talked a little bit about it, making sure that your company has a really strong performance review, essentially, you know, some sort of, whether it be quarterly, annually. But I think a lot of it is just, you know, as you have these companies, we have a lot of companies that have younger managers now. And because they want something done one way, doesn't necessarily mean that that has to be that way. So I think a lot of it is just, you know, touching base with your team and understanding what they need. You know, I have someone on my team that she has so many screens up on her monitor. She can't, if a Skype comes up, you know, everyone Skypes now. No one talks to each other really. We're in a big open environment. But if there's a Skype, she just can't see it because there's so many different things sort of going on. So we sort of communicated about that because that caused frustration from a communication standpoint. But, you know, people were complaining to me, she never checks her Skype. We don't get things done quickly. And so we had to sit down as a team and talk about, okay, how can we communicate as a team to understand what each person, you know, needs? So instead of it sort of being a, this is how it goes and everyone conforms, it's a, let's talk about this as a team and, you know, what do we need? And the answer isn't always that everyone is 100% happy. So there's a lot of give and take and a lot of, okay, let's just try it this way. And I think that's part of the thing is that people are sort of afraid to try new things because it's always been this way and that's always how we've done it. Or then you get a new person that comes in and they say, well, what if we do it this way? And everyone just sort of, I don't know. So it's a part of it is people are afraid of change. People are afraid, you know, of something new. So we really need to identify kind of what's holding people back. So those are some red flags, you know, that we see when we're talking to teams and helping hire and attract and even retain new staff.
So Genevieve, in that example that you just cited, the problems with the, excuse me, with the worker wasn't seeing the Skype because he or she had so many screens open on their monitor. Did that become an issue that the manager was made aware of, or was it the coworkers were complaining and the manager overheard it? I'm just trying to get a sense of how people get plugged into, oh, we have a problem here.
My team, we meet, you know, weekly as a team, sometimes more, sort of depending, but we have a really good, you know, we're in this as a team. So what do people need from each other that we can make sure that as a team we're growing and moving in the right direction? So, you know, I ask everyone to come to that meeting prepared with a couple of things that, you know, we sort of need from each other. And in that instance, it was, you know, several people on the team said, I feel like, you know, I get ignored, or I feel like, you know, it's not a important thing when I send you a Skype. And this person said, well, I don't even see the Skype. You know, so it wasn't as much as a, you know, this person's not paying attention to me as it was that person just wasn't embracing the technology. So we talked a little bit about, you know, that, and, you know, the end result was that, you know, if it was something that was an emergency or, you know, a really important topic, then you stand up and you have a conversation face-to-face instead of, you know, sending the Skype. So we talked a little bit about, you know, what was a 911 emergency versus a 411 informational, you know, piece. But we got through it, so that was good.
Deb, what do you hear from your clients? When do they say, hey, we need help? How do you identify red flags?
Well, yeah, Carol, I want to get back sort of to the core of what are some red flags. I mean, certainly body language is one, and we see it all the time, regardless of your generation. I mean, it's either eye-rolling or shaking their head or kind of like that. I mean, so you see body language that doesn't feel positive. That's a red flag. You know, a second red flag is language, just the way people portray what they're seeing. So they talk about the younger person, fresh ideas. Well, you know, older people have fresh ideas too. So, you know, but the term fresh ideas sort of means, well, the person must be younger. And then someone else who's old school or doesn't like change, that intonation is that it has to do with somebody older. And so when you start to hear those sorts of kind of cliche terms, to me, that's a red flag that there's something kind of going on. Another red flag we see is a really cliquey environment in the workforce that appears to be age-related. So you're always going to have cliques. You're always going to have people who like each other better and if you have a large workforce, there'll be some that don't like the other group. But if you're looking for a red flag to us, it's when you start to see those clicks be very age-specific. And so that kind of tells you that people are sticking together because of their age differences. So that's another red flag. And another one, I guess maybe last, are just assumptions. When people are when you hear, especially when you hear supervisory level people making assumptions about, you know, I assigned this work to the 25-year-old and it was too boring, they didn't want to do it. Well, maybe that's true, but maybe the work really was boring, nobody would want to do it. Might not have anything to do with that person's age. Similarly, you know, the supervisor assigns some, you know, difficult technology work to somebody who's 60 and then it doesn't go well. So, well, they're not very good with technology. Well, maybe, but the other reason might be it might have been a project that had no definition and no one could have performed. So you start to hear those generalizations, and so to me, or us, you know, body language, you know, assumptions, clicks, and all of those things, that's what you start to see when you're looking for red flags before you even get to the point of how you're going to solve it.
Well, since you're on a roll, Deb, how do you solve those?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how do you solve this? I mean, I really do think, and maybe I'm an outlier here, I don't know, but we spend a lot of time talking about our differences based on age, based on gender. And there's a point at which I think sometimes we start to look at our commonality. So if you have a positive workforce, which would be your first order of business, where everyone really is dedicated to the mission of your company, that brings everyone together, regardless of the age. And so if you start sort of with that culture piece, where everyone's in it together, they're all a team, people start to forget
about the ages or the gender or the race or whatever, because it's a team. And so one thing to start to address some of what you might see with red flags is to have leaders at the top and supervisory and mid-management people who really value having a positive, open workforce where everyone's in it together and it's a team environment. If you're not lucky enough to have people at that level, either get promoted up there or go somewhere else. But that is how, to me, to really start to bring people together is to value everyone else. And then the second thing I'm going to push up is when you're in power and you can assign teams to work together, you have a workforce to work together, mix it up. Try to put people of different age groups, even people who never work together. They have similar functions or you think they could work well together. Let them have a chance to, you know, work with each other and see, because together they'll realize a lot of commonalities that they share.
Dennis, you're itching to go.
I was itching. So I'm glad my wife isn't here, because I'm going to tell you two things that I do with her. So I've learned with companies, the best thing about addressing a problem is when you've already addressed it in what your expectations are of that employee at the beginning. So if you have a performance management system that talks about the mission, vision, values of your company, they should understand that, right? Number two, their quantitative and qualitative expectations. And three, a discussion around what is expected of you, right? As you walk in the door, irrespective of your job, what is it that we expect out of you? You should treat people fairly. You should do this, you should do this, this. So if you have an issue, it doesn't become that kind of I'm addressing a problem. It becomes you're coaching them and helping them around that. That's a different conversation, right? So that's number one. Number two is I've found that, consideration, respect, and honesty in a conversation is part and parcel of any of these conversations that you have. But here's the best tool, and this is the one my wife hates. Whenever she says, why aren't we doing this? I respond with reflection and say, honey, so your issue is that you want me to do this. If you ask for permission to get their impression on the issue that you're addressing with them, if that just made sense, and you reflect upon them, a lot of times they will see your position. So there's a company I worked with the other day. A guy was harassing a woman, right? It hadn't got innuendo and stuff. And so we addressed it with him and said, if you were in our shoes, as president of this company, how would you address this? And he said, I wouldn't tolerate it. And I said, well, then we shouldn't tolerate it, right? So I didn't, it's a little backhanded way of getting to the issue without making it appear as if you're in trouble kind of thing, right? So I would offer reflection, number one, as a tool, and above that, make sure you set the expectations when every employee comes into your building, when they're hired on day one, what the onboarding process is and what you expect of them to include this, right?
So the onboarding process needs to be very clear about what the expectations are.
Yeah. Remember a couple of things that are not going to be good statistics. Those, by the way, those statistics on that you talked about with the average amount of time that people stay with a company of 17 months, those were my statistics. So this here's what's not good. You hire somebody, hopefully you've screened them the right way. You've done everything you can so that you can find if there's anything there that wouldn't be acceptable in your company. But also you need to make sure they interview you. This is the difference today. You're not interviewing them when I interviewed. You need to have it as a two-way interview. Second problem is this. On the first day they come in, they're thinking of ways that they should leave. They're either validating or saying this was the right decision or the wrong decision. You heard the statistic on within 90 days people will leave. That, I believe Harvard Business School did a study that 18 to 20% of people will leave within 90 days. That costs you a lot of money, right? Third thing is they want to see once you onboard them, are you living up to the expectations at which their job description and why they came to you is meeting up with what they see every day? Harvard Business School did a second study that within 6 months, another 20% leave because they believe that you didn't live up to the expectations in what you said their job was all about. You cure those problems, you'll have people stay longer.
Genevieve, you want to build on that?
So I think one of the things that our company does is has a really good mentor program. And so for, you know, all of those things, you set expectations in an interview, you hire the right person, hopefully that hasn't taken you 6 months. You know, but really what happens is that in
that very early part of someone's career with your company, and even, you know, new managers. So if someone's getting promoted to be a new manager and maybe hasn't had the experience, you know, we have a huge mentor program, and it's outlined. It's about 12 weeks from a mentorship standpoint, and then we check in with people sort of monthly after that. But from that foundation of when someone walks in the door, you get partnered with, you know, another tenured person within the company to really show you the ropes. So, you know, that first day, someone's got someone bringing them to lunch, and it brings them into, you know, sort of a different aspect of the company or a different department. So, you know, that's really important if companies don't have some sort of mentorship. And, you know, I understand Maine is mostly comprised of small and medium-sized businesses, and, you know, everyone's overworked kind of as it is, right? So, you know, to ask somebody to take that time. So, you know, to incentivize people, you know, for that. Sometimes people do, you know, a small bonus, a little bit of an extra day off. There are small things that don't have to cost a lot of money. In our company, we sort of have a mentor, you know, pool, and people can look at people's profiles and their career and kind of look, and the mentee picks who that person is. And so then, you know, it's kind of fun to be tapped on the shoulder to say, hey, can you mentor this new employee and help shape their career? And I think the good thing about a mentorship type program is that it works for both ways. So there could be somebody that's, you know, starting out in their career. You get to learn from somebody who's been with the company for a while, understands, you know, the company culture. Just have another person to say, hey, what's the deal with, you know, whoever that always is frowning, you know, so you might just have another person, you know, to help you out that's not your manager, because I think that's important, you know, too. And then from the flip side, you can learn something from everybody. You know, I love it when my staff goes to trainings and they learn new things from different, you know, markets, and I ask them to bring that information back, but I feel like I can learn something, whether it be a pivot table or, you know, a shortcut, you know, within a software, just as much as, you know, someone can learn about the challenges of, you know, myself that's been in this, you know, this division in Maine in the market for 12 years. We've gone through some pretty strong ups and downs, so we can talk a little bit about that. So, I mean, I think, you know, a mentor program is something that I would highly recommend if people aren't doing. And then, you know, again, just kind of checking base with your employees. That's going to help retention and have new hires stick around a little bit longer.
Genevieve, you do the mentor program with every new hire. I've heard a lot of companies do that when they hire middle managers or others, kind of at that level and above, but I haven't heard that with every new hire.
Every new hire. I mean, we have a small office in Maine. We have 14 people, so it's not large. And, you know, every new person that starts in our company, we've had some growth, you know, this year, so we've added, they get brought to lunch. You know, they have someone to greet them in the morning. You know, they get taken to lunch. And then, you know, sort of, it's a pretty intense program from, you know, every week to, you know, some daily check-ins. And then it kind of continues from there. So I'm going to lunch with somebody today that I mentored for a while, and she's doing really well. And so it's a nice thing for us to kind of touch base. And I'm sort of like the mother hen in our office because I've been there so long. I, you know, if the dishwasher doesn't work, I know how to fix it. You know, so that's kind of a fun thing, you know, to be able to do. And I've shaped a lot of people's careers. You know, the person who manages our branch right now, I hired, and, you know, he had a tough time along the way, and now he's, you know, our branch manager. I opened a division. So, you know, people kind of pull that. It feels good, and it helps me, you know, kind of remember on those stressful days that, you know what, I work for a really great company that cares about our employees, and, you know, we've had some pretty good retention from that standpoint.
Great.
That's awesome.
One of the one of the things that we're seeing more of in Maine, because there's such a need for workers, there's been a lot of pressure applied to more senior folks to stay at their jobs and not retire because they don't have someone who's been groomed to replace them just yet. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, with a larger portion of the workforce that's now 55 and older, are there specific strategies for retaining older workers? And then sort of the other side of that, how will multi-generational issues change when Gen Z makes up a greater portion of the workforce? Go ahead, Deb.
The strategies for retaining older workers is really not very different than the strategies for retaining younger workers.
Okay.
You know, everyone talks about flexibility. It doesn't matter what age you are. You know, the 25-year-olds have the opportunities to telecommute. Well, guess what? So do the 60-year-olds. People want to have an opportunity every now and then to take a Friday afternoon off. But what generation is that? It's every generation. So again, I kind of come back and I say, well, really have
a vibrant workforce that's valuing the things that everyone in the workforce cares about, everyone's going to stay. So an older worker might be more likely, I guess, to want a 3 or 4 day week just because they've been working 5 day weeks for 40 years. Maybe that's true. But at the end of the day, there are plenty of younger people, too, who would love a 3 or 4 day work week if they could afford it. So certainly flexibility, certainly telecommuting. Certainly opportunities for part-time work. Sometimes people like the opportunity to be able to take leave without pay. So if they have an opportunity to go somewhere awesome and they can afford it, they like an employer who's flexible within the confines, obviously, of getting the job done and moving the business forward. But so I think those things certainly can be attractive to retaining older workers in the workforce, but it also goes the same way with the younger workers. So
I feel like I'm in an interview right now since I fit into that over 50 thing. But, you know, a guy came to me a couple weeks ago at a company. We were interviewing, and so the interviewer, there was probably two kids for a VP of sales job, maybe 35 to 38, and this guy was 56 years old. He had the best resume in the world. And he came to me after the interview and he said, I'm not going to get this because I'm going to cost too much. And I said, well, that's really not the case. You need to position yourself of value to a smaller, medium-sized business. So this is what he did, and I thought it was cool, and I wanted to share it with you. He came back to him and he said, I know the cost of hiring somebody and training them. I'm not going anywhere. He brought the Harvard Business School stat in and said, the person you're about to hire is going to be gone in a year and a half. I'm not going to be gone. But here's how you can get me. So he flips it. He said, you don't have to hire me at that level. You don't even have to give me benefits. Medical, my wife has those, so you can cut that out. He said, I'm flexible even working on weekends for trade shows and stuff like that. So don't think that as you're older that you don't have benefits, especially to small to medium-sized businesses. That is, negotiate on that. It works. He was hired because he was flexible and understood the needs of the company. And I think that that's important. So if you're over 55 or over 60, and even over 65, there are people who still want to work. Guys like me, my wife kicks me out because I'm a pain in the neck and I'm bored. So you want to work, you have a lot of value, but use those things to help yourself be employed. It's a big value to small to medium-sized businesses.
Did he have to take a really significant reduction in the pay he was requesting?
So interesting. So this was a VP of sales job. So there's kind of, a variable compensation and then your salary. So the comp package was like 150. He said, I'll take less on a base salary, but you're going to pay me more because I'm going to overachieve on the variable comp. Let me prove to you that I can do it in year one. And he's 6 months in, or a couple months in now, already blown it away. So that's how he negotiated that.
Interesting.
But that would make more.
Right. I know. We'll fist bump later on, you and I.
Genevieve, do you have anything to add to the 55 and older, how to keep them happy in the workplace, or what you see as maybe some changes coming on the horizon because of the advent of Gen Z folks?
Everyone wants to be happy, right? And so, it doesn't matter, what age you are and, things from that end. I work with a lot of presidents and CFOs of companies, and when I talk to them about why positions are open, whether it be for succession planning or whether it be for, growth, a lot of the times folks that have been within those companies, they don't want to lose, more tenured staff members because of they have leadership and just a lot of legacy knowledge of companies, right? So I think when we start losing folks that have been with the companies for 10, 15, years, even longer, the challenge of not knowing, all of that history of the company and the core values of what that company is, sort of been built on, gets to be a little bit of a challenge. So, some of the things, in our company, did a little bit of research. They talked a little bit about, some folks in retirement age, if there's even a standard of what that is anymore, some folks aren't able to retire, and some folks want to keep working. And in Maine, we really do need every possible person that can be working, to work. So a lot of the challenges becomes, what do we do to make things easier for folks that might be, having to care for older parents and, might having to, care for children and things from that end. A lot of companies are trying to get creative with sort of, can we do telecommuting? Can we work a flex schedule? Could somebody stay on as a consultant if, they're not necessarily ready to be done? So I think oftentimes too, folks are sort of embarking on new careers. We are in a high time of growth. And so sometimes people are taking the knowledge that they've had with one company and bringing it to somebody else. So there's a lot of things that, companies can and are doing to kind of retain that talent for sure.
So would you say that flexibility is now the norm? Because you have all made some reference to flexibility in the workplace as a way to keep workers happy. And I understand that, but I come from an industry where there are deadlines, and those deadlines are incredibly inflexible. And so how do you reconcile having flexibility in the workforce, but you have deadlines, you have clients that need to have projects completed by certain times? I'm just curious, how do you balance those things, and is flexibility now the norm? Go ahead, whoever wants.
I think, flexibility is sort of now the norm. I know that, I think we were talking a little bit about this, Carol, when, so my company, we used to work
8 to 6, Monday through Friday. That was our work week. And I was really nervous when, and I was usually the first one in the office and stuck around, you know, late. And then when I was coming back from maternity leave, I was so stressed out about the fact, like, I have to pick up daycare at 5:30. And I have a team that if I'm not in the office, what are they going to think about me? So I had a lot of internal challenges as far as I want to come back to work, you know, but can I come back to work here? And I was, you know, really fortunate around that time that my company, I went to them with my challenges and said, you know, I feel like I'm going to fail the team. And I feel like as a manager, if I'm not the first one in the office or the last one to leave. And they said, well, let's talk about that a little bit. And, you know, thankfully we were at a spot where we were opening a new division, which I need to be a little bit more flexible. I work with people who are permanently employed. So that means putting my son to bed and then jumping on a Skype interview or doing something sort of from that aspect. But I was happier at work from that standpoint, and I tend to work more now. You know, I'm available on weekends and things from that perspective. So, you know, my sort of internal battle of a typical workday for me changed, but it's been wonderful. You know, I can, if daycare is closed for one day, I can, you know, work from home or still be available. We have, you know, email on phone now. And I think they've talked a little bit about, you know, productivity, you know, going up for folks that feel like they have a little bit more flexibility. So I know one person that I've done a lot of work with, she works from home on Fridays. And she said, I get more done on Friday at my house when I can lock myself in the basement. You know, she's like, I don't have to take a shower, so I'm working earlier. You know, and then I don't have sort of the deli line outside my door where people are coming in and saying, I need this or I need, you know, something. So I think it is becoming the norm. And, you know, there's you know, to Debbie's point, it's not necessarily millennials or different generations that are driving that. You know, it's both sides of the coin. So I think that, you know, from a deadline-driven standpoint, you have to have that expectation of, you know, are you getting your work done? And then that goes back down to your employee reviews or keeping people accountable is, you know, is it working or is it not? And you can do things with, you know, but you kind of have to do it for everybody, right? So that's the other challenge is making sure that if you're going to have a flexible work schedule that, you know, it's a well guidelined, you know, thing of what works and what doesn't. You know, you can't just be at home every day and push a button on your computer that shows you're working and logged in. So, you know, you have to really look at how productive are people being when they're not in the office.
And also, I mean, Carol, your point's a good one. I mean, we're not entitled to our jobs. The company, it's the company. That's who we work for. And if it's a company, whether it's a hospital or a newspaper, that has very specific deadlines, it's absolutely true that it may be harder to be flexible. That's not to say they can't get creative with job shares or trading off work or people, teams doing work. There's tons of ways to be creative. But at the end of the day, it's true, it's very different when your company is a service delivery company. That's the mission, and people have deadlines, they have to be there. It is more challenging, but I do think it's
I'd imagine I have something to say on this. So it reminds me of something Ronald Reagan said a number of years ago to the Russians, trust but verify, right? So if they're going to ask for something or you're going to do something for them and be flexible on time, then they should be able to live up to their end of the bargain as well. In other words, you don't want to get run over, right? So second thing is that imagine you as a manager. And I'd like to flip this on its end. This is a great opportunity as a manager. I've managed, when you talked about, you know, and my wife had this situation, you know, when we had kids. She was so paranoid about the fact she was done with her PTO, done with her other days off, and she, you know, kids are sick, and I'm in California. So what her company developed, small medical device company, it was each week when they huddle for sales, they have a I've got your back session. And people will say, I need help on this day. And then the other person will say, I'll help you, or the manager will help them. And you get that back in spades. If you hire go-givers and good people and you screen them the right way, and you give to them, they will give back. right? It works 100% of the time. So I think everybody's flexibility is based upon their own reality. Remember I talked about earlier on their performance plan, so you've got the mission, vision, values, you've got their quantitative, qualitative. There's also a section I forgot that the most important section, and that's the me section for that person. What is it that you want out of this company, and what can I do as a manager to help you on an ongoing basis? You should have two or three things to help them with their performance. That means a lot to employees, no matter what their age is.
So before we go to the Q&A part of the forum this morning, can you guys just kind of give me your top three best practices to create an open and respectful workplace? You sort of have all, we've all been going around it, so maybe we could just synthesize it into your top three pieces of advice. Anyone? Sure.
One is, I would just say, don't stereotype, you know, just because somebody is in a class of, you know, generations. You know, everyone has different, you know, things, you know, from that, that aspect that are important to them. So I would really just say, you know, again, don't stereotype. Make sure that you have a strong sort of open line of communication with all levels to understand, you know, what's important to people, what they want to get out of their workday every day. And then, you know, communicate. That's the number one thing that, you know, people just don't do. We're in a you know, digital age where you can Skype someone, where you can have a, you know, email, where you can have all sorts of conversations. You know, you can break up with people over, you know, virtual forum. But I think the thing that, you know, and that's important to my team is that they know they can come to me with anything. And we are in a big open space all day. And there are some times that someone's not comfortable saying something out loud. And, you know, we talk about that a lot. You know, why are you afraid of how this person's feelings, you know, are? And why is their feelings more important than yours? You know, so there's a lot of things that we communicate day in and day out. But I think that that's part of the problem is that people, you know, just say, well, it doesn't matter what I think anyway, so they're afraid to have a conversation. So communication is just key.
I agree with all of that, Genevieve. And in addition, I really do think that a lot of our disconnects in interpersonal relationships are because we don't know one another, or we don't really value what that person is about because we don't know. And so kind of back to my point before about structuring project teams to the extent you can in your workplace that really mix it up with people who don't normally work together, I think goes a long way to making people understand one another and also having some camaraderie. And the other thing increasingly, and you see it a lot in best places to work where people say, why is this such a great place to work? Well, you know, we get together every Thursday night and have beers down the road. And that's a great sort of team building thing, but it's very stereotypical. And it may not, the person who has to pay for daycare or has no money or maybe has an alcohol problem isn't the one who wants to go out Thursday night, every Thursday night for beers. So while I think that's a great idea to start to build this camaraderie in your workplace, mix it up, you know, do some lunchtime events in the workplace to get people getting to know one another, because usually when people get to know each other, they like each other better, and then they work together better. So I do think that we need to spend more time on mixing up the generations and the large diversity now that we have in all of our workplaces with respect to age, gender, race, you know, disability. I mean, there are immigrants. The immigrants are coming in. There's a lot of people in these workplaces now that I think, I hate to stereotype, but I think 20 years ago maybe there weren't that many different people. So let's have at it and get people together, working together. They'll have a lot more fun, and I think the company will be more productive too.
How about you, Dennis? What are your top three?
Yeah, so I actually wrote these down, so let me put my glasses on. You know, I think we've said this over and over again. Upfront, clearly define expectations, not once, not twice, but all the time. The companies that I see where they have their mission, vision, values, and they live it, they begin every meeting with, remember, this is what we're all about. You're going to get people on your team. Or, better yet, I mean, you know, everybody may not be part of your team. you'll weed them out that way. If they don't walk in and live that, they don't have to sing Kumbaya and all that kind of stuff at the fireplace. But if they're not living or understanding your mission, vision, values and live that, then, you know, they probably shouldn't be in your company, and that's okay. The second thing is something we haven't talked about, but is a problem. And I talk with leaders about this. They have their mission, vision, values. They tell people what they want. They don't live it themselves. What is wrong with that? You know, my toughest job is, so when I consult with companies, I tell them the first day I go in, we're going to have a hard discussion, because 50% of the companies I work with, I'm going to come back to you as the owner or president or CEO and tell you you are the problem. You have to decide what you want to do. You'll probably fire me, but, you know, then you're not going to be able to hire anybody. You've got to deal with that. The other thing, too, is how about this novel notion? And we've talked about addressing problems. How about talking about the good things? You know, remember the old days, people would get Zapgrams or you'd get a Dunkin' Donuts card for doing something great. And it wasn't a whole lot. When millennials were asked, another study, I forgot which, I think Brown University did this. The number one thing they wanted before pay and flexibility was recognition of small things they did to help other people. Why are we not recognizing this? Recognize people for the good things. Accentuate the positive and not talk about the negative. That would be my third thing. It works.
Great. So now just I realize we need a little lightning round, because our promotions for this event said are using emojis, unprofessional, and ellipses. Is that passive-aggressive behavior? And what do you do about people who can't Google anything? So just a really quick, if people could answer those three questions that we posed in our promotional materials before we take questions from the audience, that would be great. Just quick.
Emojis are never professional in the work setting. I think that, you know, there's a time and place for them, but, you know, in a work email or any of those things, I mean, a lot of people are using their cell phones now for, you know, back and forth with folks. Just, you know, keep it professional, you know, try not to do things. They can be misinterpreted, and, you know, there's a trap of everything digital. So, you know, I've certainly had conversations about how someone, you know, put an emoji that was, you know, not received well from the other person, and it caused a huge problem. So my thought is that keep them out of, you know, work emails and, you know, professional communication.
And set that stage. I mean, set the stage that, oh, you know, or if your company's fine with it, I mean, I guess that's okay, right?
But to make that clear,
be clear about it
during the onboarding process.
Yeah.
Okay. How about ellipses? I was surprised that ellipses are considered passive-aggressive. I use them all the time because I'm never quite fully finished with my thought, and so I just throw ellipses in there, and I found out, what? Passive-aggressive? No, that's not what I intended at all. Somebody bail me out? No?
I would say this. With any level of communication, this is what I say to my 15-year-old son as he's not communicating well, and the LOL and the bro and all that other stuff. This is what I say to companies. If you think that's cool, then say that to a client and see how quickly you lose the business. That's your litmus test. You know, if we're offline, you can talk to me any way you want. As a matter of fact, I encourage that with companies. You want to hang with me and talk like that. What you know, the analogy of in football that I had was, when we're in the huddle, you say whatever you want. When we break the huddle and we're going to fight, it's a different ball game. We have to be professional, and we have to understand that we are not going to tell people what they want to see. They're going to tell us what they want to hear. They don't want to hear that. And I always tell, especially the younger kids too, is this: no one takes you seriously when you talk like that to a client or a partner or a distributor, whatever it is. Rarely do they, right? So that to me is the litmus test for all that kind of communication stuff.
And how about someone who needs help with some really basic fundamental technology issues? Is that something that you expect coworkers to help you with, or how do you assess if that's going to be an issue that someone needs some remedial attention?
Well, that's a training thing regardless of age.
Okay.
That's, to Dennis's point, I mean, that's part, I would just say that's part of onboarding, that we wouldn't really stereotype that certain people, not that you work here, but, you know, that certain age groups are going to have a harder time may be true, it may not totally not be true. It really may have to do with the initial training at the outset to make sure that your employees can operate your technology.
And
when you're hiring them, with Gen V, with all the recruiting you do, that you're looking at people who meet whatever the requirements are for that employer.
And that those are, again, are expectations that are laid out at the time you're interviewing or hiring. Okay.
I mean, that's a condition of employment. Mm-hmm. It's that simple, right? So.
Well, and, you know, installed a new CRM 3 years ago, and they're constantly updating them and challenging them. And I'm learning something new all the time, you know, and so I have no problem going to someone and saying, can you help me? You know, and that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, if you don't ask the question, then that causes, you know, a bigger problem. So, you know, you can Google anything with Excel spreadsheets and go on YouTube and learn how to do something. So it can take some initiative on your end, but ask someone who's really good at it how you can get it better, or if they can just show you a quick trick.
I think that mutual mentoring that we need to support is just so appropriate there. I mean, when we have a vibrant workplace where everyone's in it together, there isn't, you're not worried if you're 16-year-old, you're not worried about asking the younger person how to do that from the inputs or something. You don't worry about that because you know it's going to come back the other way. You know, that person's going to ask you, the older person, like, why did you do it that way? And how'd you get to this place? So there's all kinds of cross-germination of information when people are mentoring one another, and then they feel open to asking.
And I think just really quickly, one of the things that you look at with the different sort of generations is that, you know, we're talking about millennials. Millennials want to be a partner, right? So how can you be a partner with somebody if you're afraid to ask somebody a question, or you're afraid to, you know, that you're going to be shut down, or you want someone to come to you to learn your knowledge. So I think that's one big thing about that particular generation, that they want to partner with folks where, you know, different generations want to be included and then other people want to be taught. So, you know, I think if you're looking specifically at the millennial place, that partnership is really important to everybody.
So these are opportunities.
Correct.
Great. So how about some questions from the audience? Can you use the mic, please? We record these and then we post them online afterwards, so it's just helpful to have the microphone.
That was the fastest hand raised I've ever seen in my life.
First, thank you for sharing this information. It's really really interesting, and I think across the board, but especially in our state with our demographics. I guess my question is about non-digital interpersonal communication in the workplace, and if you're seeing challenges or trends, you know, related to that, and if there are maybe activities or strategies that businesses can do to help. Like, for example, Dennis, you mentioned that you about this, you know, if there's a problem, the worker might go directly to the president. But my question would be, well, how did they do that? Was it a face-to-face, or did they just fire off an email? And that creates, obviously, a lot of other issues along the way. So that's my question.
Are you addressing it to me?
I just think in general, if you are seeing things out there, and if, you know, there's a way to compensate.
Well, I've seen everything happen from a text to the president, LOL, I got a problem, dude. You know, that type of thing. I think that one of the best classes I've ever taken in my career was a class called It's a Matter of Respect. It's an HR class. There are ones that are given now that talks about now, and it's been updated for this generation. And you can Google it. You know, someone can come in or you can take it online. It talks about effective communication, digital, you know, cubicle to cubicle, breaking rank and file, going above people, all this. And it what it does is that I think companies should have that training for everybody who comes in, because it sets the stage. Remember I said earlier, instead of addressing a problem, you want to coach through a problem. When you give that at the beginning, I think it is absolutely integral in any onboarding is, here's the way we expect you to communicate to everybody within our organization. Now you've set the bar, right? Now you can do it. And by the way, the other thing too is your gut's going to tell you what's right and wrong, okay? The problem isn't what your gut tells you. It's that if you respond, you're worried. In our day and age, everything's a problem. Your shoes are a problem. Your hair is a problem. Your political affiliation's a problem. I'm offended. You as a company have to make the decision, as I think Debbie said, You work for me. There are expectations. Okay? Or you don't have to work here. It's okay. You don't need rogue people in your organization.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to address that? Or Dennis covered it well. Okay, next question. Hi, Susan.
Oh, good morning. Excellent panel, as always. Thank you. My question has to do with what your thoughts are on community engagement and the role that plays in attracting and retaining people. And I guess I would look at it in two categories. To what extent is it encouraged that employees or team members get engaged in industry associations and attend events and, you know, volunteer on committees? And then also, what about philanthropic or social impact engagement with some of the nonprofits? And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are for what role that plays in our workplace today. Thank you.
Increasingly, we do a lot of employee handbooks and HR consulting. And almost, I would say virtually all companies now are in some way having some reference to community engagement, either giving employees, sometimes it's only 5 hours a year, or giving them half a day off, you know, every quarter to volunteer in their community. We're seeing it more and more, and I do believe that 20 or 30 years ago that wasn't as common. So I think there's a real move afoot, and it's probably driven by the workforce, regardless of age, by the workforce wanting to be more community-minded. And it also is good for the company, because it gets the company involved in healthcare. So we see a
we do, and Debbie's point earlier about getting teams together, you know, not necessarily in a drinking setting or, you know, lunch. You know, we've volunteered at, you know, the soup kitchens. We have done, you know, drives for suits, and we've, you know, we volunteer some time for new Mainers as far as interview tips and things from that standpoint. But it's a fun way to get together with your team outside of your normal work standard. And we, you know, don't necessarily, there are companies that will give someone an extra CTO day, or there are companies that will, you know, do something extra for people who raise their hand and say that they want to give back. You know, we just leave work a little bit early and have a skeleton staff. And, you know, that's a really fun thing to say, that you were giving back to the community. So I think overwhelmingly, when you see these best places to work in Maine, or people put as part of their benefits package, even, you know, some of the things that they're doing to give back, it is helpful to kind of get involved. And we encourage new folks to get involved in, you know, different memberships and sort of get out and network, you know, because the face-to-face is so important, as opposed to just sort of, you know, making a phone call or shooting an email.
I just had something in that too, as you might imagine. A day of giving or days of giving throughout the year are great. And here's the reason why. It builds teamwork. People get a perspective. Timberland, down where I live in the Portsmouth, New Hampshire area, did those things, the murals. They helped with those all over the seacoast of Maine and New Hampshire, and they do those quarterly. They found that productivity the week after doing their day of giving, where you had the president down to administrative assistant in jeans working together, there's no rank and file there. Nobody tells that you're working together. Cause them to be more productive the month after those than any other months throughout the year. Those are the facts. It works. So I would encourage it. It's a great idea.
Terrific. And you, sir, have our last question of the morning.
Oh, the pressure's on. No, thank you all. Excellent discussion. There's been a lot of talk about performance evaluation and evaluations and communication, and I was wondering if any of the panelists would like to comment on 360-degree performance evaluations and their experience with those. Thanks.
Well, they can work. I think they're handled professionally. And I think it's important to get them set up with a little outside help sometimes, so that, and so that's the first thing. And the second thing is the people at the top really have to be engaged in it and want to hear honestly what some of the comments will be, because as you know, Todd, the whole point of the 360 is 360. So I think if it's set up well, and the management is engaged in it, I think it can be awesome.
Do you find that there's
like there's not a barrier, that people don't really check their comments in a 360 review because there's that element of anonymity. I just wonder how that goes for companies where there may be some, I don't know, some problems in the workplace, and people will sort of hold their fire until there's a 360 review of their manager and poof.
Well, I mean, I feel like if they're holding their, you know, their input or their feelings until then, there's a bigger problem.
You know, but I think that, you know, they have to be done timely, in a timely manner, and they have to be, you have to be able to, you know, put into place and address the problems, you know, because if you don't, then people won't take them seriously, mm-hmm. And they won't give you their real, you know, feelings. So I think it's a couple of things. It's not just sort of a one-time annual review, you know, because, you know, there's a bigger problem if you're not addressing these things as they come about. But then you have to be prepared to be able to act on even the hard, you know, challenges that come about from it.
Dennis, do you want to weigh in?
I'm a big believer in analytics behind any decision making on hiring people and maintaining people within your organization and getting other people's feedback. On the front end, I'm a big believer in background checks. I'm a big believer in assessments, only because it reduces your risk. For $150, do it. By the way, on the background checks, you know, if you're not doing that, that's a big red flag, because if anybody has a financial problem, they typically are someone who's going to steal from your company. That's a 90% certainty. So you want to check that. And then when you're within the company, I'm a big believer in that. 360 degree, you know, the first time I did one, I was vice president at Siemens. I was horrified. Exactly. You know, I'm thinking, oh my God, what's going to come up? And there was good feedback. And the way I handled it and what helped me is I said, look, here's what you're saying about me. I'm going to fix this problem. People love that, and I did, because it wasn't about me just being the boss. It was me getting better for them.
I think that, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the one thing, too, you think of as a management team is, right, you're working for your team. And so if someone's afraid to tell you how you feel, that how they feel, and you're not working towards the same common goal, you're just sort of spinning your wheels, you know. So you'd have to be able to kind of think about it that way. But who doesn't like to get feedback, good, bad, indifferent? I mean, we're all big people, right? And, you know, we're grown-ups and adults, and we can... I would like to think, you know, we can take some criticism and be able to do better for it. Right, right.
But I think it's important to get some help, either internally or something, to really, you know, structure one that's, you know, properly structured and implemented and analyzed. So, yeah.
Great. Well, will you please join me in thanking our panelists this morning?